Listener supported. WNYC Studios. So
it's a slow ride to learning an instrument. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today on the show, we hear from a guitar hero. Vernon Reed joins us with an update on his WNYC commissioned piece, Artificial Africa. But we start with a guitar zero. That's what the cognitive psychologist Gary Marcus called himself a few years ago when he wanted to learn to play the instrument. But there were two problems. Number one, he had no sense of rhythm. And number two, he was almost 40 years old. So Gary set out to tackle the question, is it ever too late to learn? The results are the book, Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. Gary Marcus, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the saying is you can't teach an old dog new tricks. What about people?
It's a little bit of a lie for dogs, and it's definitely a lie for people. So you can teach old dogs new tricks. When I wrote this book, I thought I was kind of alone trying to start this at 40, but I've gotten a million emails from people that are much older, no problem at all. Like one person said, I just gave your book to my dad. He's 76. He's been playing for 2 years, and he's starting a new band called The Three Grandfathers.
Nice. So it was a kind of a personal quest that got you started on this exploration of what? Is there such a thing as innate musicality seems to be a recurring theme.
That's a theme. I knew the answer to that when I set out. There is such a thing, and I don't have it. But there's a question of how far you can get if you don't have it.
Now, how do you know you don't have it?
Well, I had a lot of traumatic childhood experiences. Like, I tried to play Mary Had a Little Lamb to take the recorder lessons, and the teacher said, after I'd tried it for a few weeks or something like that, she said, you know, perhaps your talents lay elsewhere, which was true. I mean, I was better off as a scientist than being in a rock band, but probably not the best thing for a teacher to say. I think the right thing for the teacher would have been to say, I noticed that you don't seem to notice the difference between short notes and long notes. Let's put that difficult Mary Had a Little Lamb song to the side for a moment. Let's just practice short note, long note. Short.
Right.
And she probably could have taught me if she had been patient enough. But I had a bunch of experiences like that. Another one was when I was in graduate school, they came out with this thing called the Miracle Piano, which you hooked up to your Macintosh, and it was like a typing tutor. And the first lessons were fine. I learned where the C note was and where the E note was. That was no sweat. But then you had to get the rhythm exactly right. And I do have a problem, an innate problem with rhythm. And so I got stuck and I gave up, and there were no miracles with the Miracle Piano.
And we started the show with Fog Hat's Slow Ride. You had a disastrous experience with that too.
Yeah, I kept trying for years. I always, any time I could find some way of getting musical, I tried to do it. And so when a friend told me how much fun Guitar Hero was, I went out and I bought the game and I played it. And everybody else said it was fun. I thought it was idiotic because all you have is a bunch of colored dots falling down the screen. You press buttons on a plastic guitar in time with it. I didn't really get it, and I played very badly. So what happens is if you play badly, the crowd starts to boo. And
right.
The first song was Slow Ride, which I'm still traumatized by. Thank you for playing it on the air. And so I would fail out of the song. Eventually, the crowd boos so much that you're done, and it says fail in giant letters. It was not very motivating the first time around, and I gave up. But then my wife played Rock Band, which is a kind of similar game, with some friends of hers on a business trip, and she came home all excited about it. And I was so tired of playing video games alone, feeling lame, a college professor playing video games by himself. I was like, all right, if my wife wants to play Guitar Hero, I'll bring it out. And she was able to help me get through the first song by telling me when I was too late and when I was too early. And after a little while, I was actually able to play that song, and then I made it all the way through the beginner's level and then the medium level. And then I said, if I can do this, maybe I can play a real guitar. And the other thing that was going on was I'm a scientist. That's my day job. And the science about old dogs and new tricks was kind of, it used to seem very clear cut. Like once you're 16, you start thinking about sex, you'll never learn anything again. But it's not true. It turns out there are adults that can learn foreign languages like natives. It turns out there are animal studies where if the animals try to take things step by step instead of doing it all at once, they're just fine. So if adults give themselves the slack, they're patient enough to allow themselves to improve, they can.
All right. Now, another theory that you kind of pick apart in the course of the book, Guitar Zero, is this idea that there is a music instinct. Now, that's different from an innate kind of musical gift.
That's right.
You know, I think when Vernon Reed joins us later, I think we will hear somebody with a gift.
That's right. And Vernon didn't start till he was 16. We just talked in the reception room. Like Tom Morello, who didn't start till he was 17.
From Rage Against the Machine.
From Rage Against the Machine. I talk about Tom. I interview Tom in the book. So that talent doesn't necessarily emerge early. And it's not necessarily that, like, Vernon or Tom has a gene for music, although they're obviously insanely great players. But they, I can talk more about Tom than Vernon because I know him a little better. Tom has, first of all, enormous self-discipline. So he didn't start till he was 17, but once he found the guitar, he knew it was his great love. And he went to Harvard, did an honors political science degree, and still managed to practice 8 hours a day. And so that's like an incredible amount of drive and discipline. Mm. And that's something that's probably genetic. It's not a gene for music. Then probably both of these guys had, you know, wonderful sense of pitch even before they were playing instruments. So there are different genes that affect music. It's just that there's no one box in the head that's the music box and no one gene that's the music gene. But I didn't have most of the genes that were relevant. I didn't have the ones for a good sense of time, for a good sense of pitch. The only thing I maybe had going for me was a good sense of self-discipline.
Mm-hmm. And a desire to learn how to play the guitar. Now, what were you hoping at the end of this journey to accomplish? What did you aspire to? I mean, you dropped the name Hendrix left and right in this book. Were you going for Hendrix?
No, I didn't want to be Hendrix, but I maybe wanted to understand Hendrix better. So as a scientist, I always listened to music and wanted to not just be like a spectator, but if not exactly a participant per se, a more informed spectator. And so one of the reasons was just to understand better what I was listening to. And I read a lot of books about music all along, but they'd be like biographies. They didn't really explain how the music worked. And I don't think you can really get a visceral sense until you do try to play an instrument. And I don't talk as much about this in the book, but I've also played around with GarageBand and composition. And so I've, in a lot of different ways, I've tried to understand sort of how the music works.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of it. And the other part is I just always loved listening to music. I spent all my money on CDs when I had a little more money on high-end audio equipment and stuff like that. So I was always an obsessed listener. And as a scientist, I wanted to get into it.
So, a scientist and a fan of Jimi Hendrix, although now Gary Marcus can maybe understand a little bit more of the nuts and bolts behind songs like this. You know, I've got my lady messing around town, and I gave her the gun. I shot her! Hendrix, the song is Hey Joe. My guest is Gary Marcus. He studies evolution, language, and cognitive development at NYU, where he's professor of psychology and director of their Center for Language and Music. And we're talking about his new book, Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. So now when you listen to Jimi Hendrix.
Well, what I always think of is actually one of my favorite quotes in the book, which is something Steve Vai said to a friend of mine. He said, I can play every note that Jimi Hendrix can play, and I can play it just like he played it, exactly the way he played it, but I'll never figure out how he managed to know how to play it in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And also I think there's probably a lot of guitarists who can, you know, listen to that record and play those notes in the right order, and yet somehow there's something sort of specific to Hendrix.
He has an incredible sense of rhythm, and he has an incredible sense of harmony. He would figure out his own chord voicings and stuff like that. Tom Morello actually wrote something in, maybe it was Rolling Stone recently, about Jimi Hendrix, and just talked about like the amazing way in which Hendrix would pick out his own chord voicings. And part of what's amazing about that is he didn't have any training in music theory.
Right.
And yet he still managed to have this unconscious knowledge of how everything fit together that's just stunning.
But as a lefty, he sort of had to figure it out himself. You, on the other hand, conventional, right-handed, would-be guitarist, as you set on down this road to learn to play an instrument, despite some what must have seemed to be pretty big obstacles, what was your first step? What did you do first?
There were two first steps. The first was I decided a particular time was going to be the time when it was now or never. So at the end of the summer, my wife and I often go up to a cottage that our parents have in Quebec, and I brought a guitar and also a piano keyboard. I wasn't sure at that point which instrument. I was more sure that I wanted to do an instrument. And I set aside some time. I said, I'm going to do it 8 hours a day for the next 2 weeks. I'm not going to do anything else. This is going to be my mission, and I'll see if I can get anywhere. And then the other thing is, in keeping with these animal studies that say adults need bite-sized steps, I found a book called Crash Course Acoustic Guitar by David Mead, and that really broke things down into little steps. And I really needed the baby-sized steps at first. I couldn't play even the most basic chord at first.
You write in the book that you did come down on the side of the guitar, despite the fact that the piano is more comprehensible, the way the notes are laid out, whereas the guitar is actually sort of counterintuitive.
That's right. Ultimately, I think you have to choose an instrument if you're going to choose one out of just love of the sound. And so guitar is less straightforward. And there are people like Pat Metheny, who I also interviewed, that are known as guitarists but actually compose at the piano because it's easier to find the harmonies and find the chords. And then they laboriously translate that into guitar because they're known as guitarists. Of course, I'm not known as a guitarist, so I don't have that particular problem. But the guitar is much less straightforward. The fretboard is much more complicated. So on the piano, you sit there, you can learn in an hour where the notes all are. You find it in one octave, and then you can find it everywhere. But a guitar, every string is different, and I still struggle with that even after a couple of years because the way the human memory is organized, if things are similar to one another, then they tend to blur together in our memory. So you have a whole bunch of strings that have the same notes but in different orders, and that's just not an easy thing for the human brain to learn.
And there are so many ways to approach learning an instrument. Your method seems to be a good one. Break it down into little bits. Be really, have some time, spend time and patience. And the results, well, this is an early result, one of Gary's early practice sessions on the route to becoming a guitar zero. That is Gary Marcus. He is a respected author and cognitive psychologist. What are we doing to your reputation?
My musical reputation has just plummeted from zero to the negative numbers.
That is an early practice tape. So this is like April of 2009.
Yeah, I've been practicing maybe 6 months. The only thing I can say in my defense is it was the first time that I ever tried to record myself, and so I was a little bit nervous about the recording equipment, but it's not a very good excuse, I know.
Well, but that's early days, and I think a lot of our listeners are kind of interested to find out how you progressed and where you wound up. And listeners, have you ever been in Gary's shoes? Did you pick up an instrument later in life? How did it go? Or is there an instrument you've always wanted to play but never found your way into it? Or do you have a question for Gary Marcus? Just give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Or leave a comment on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. And some comments have already actually, Gary, come in. So let's go into the control room. Joel Meyer has them.
John, our listener Ashley writes, I took up the cello in my late 20s. I'm still not very good, but it brings me happiness to be able to play it. Our Facebook friend Jason posted a link in our feed about the actor Samuel L. Jackson and his late start on the guitar, which happened on the set of the 2006 movie Black Snake Moan. And also on Facebook, Matthew says that it can be hard for adults to find a place to learn. He writes, I teach music. Many teachers will not accept adults. I do. They're very challenging at times. That said, I've seen people progress in leaps and bounds.
Gary, the book sort of details you going to people like Tom Morello and other known, respected guitarists for lessons. You started, though, with Dan Levitin, another neuropsychologist and author.
Yes, Dan and I have a slightly different memory of what happened, but basically he tried to give me a few guitar lessons. This was a little bit before his first book came out, the one that everybody knows.
Musicophilia? Your Brain on Music.
Yeah. And so he tried to give me a couple of lessons. I knew him because my wife was teaching in the same department at McGill as he was. And he re-inspired this latent urge to play guitar. And he gave me a couple lessons. I went home. I tried to play some, I don't know, A minor chords and stuff like that. And when I came back, I was all proud that I had managed to do them. But he saw immediately that my rhythm was just way off. The difference of opinion is that by the next day, I had sent an email to an expert saying, I think I have congenital arrhythmia. And Dan doesn't think that he said that. Maybe I figured that out from what he was saying. But it was pretty clear to both of us that I just could not track the metronome. And for a long time, that was pretty hard. Now I can at least play quarter notes in time with the metronome pretty reliably.
You write in the book that you've had problems with your, is it the vestibular system, which involves balance and stuff. So you would always get like sick in the backseat of a car. You avoided roller coasters.
Swings. Even a swing was a little rough on me.
So this is all about, I mean, is this part and parcel of how your body?
I think it's connected. I mean, we'd have to do a brain scan and probably we'd have to do a post-mortem brain scan. And I'm not into that to really know for sure. But it seems fairly plausible that in normal people, the vestibular system has a lot to do with rhythm, for walking and as well as for music. And for me, that system probably wasn't very well developed. And I may, in fact, be using different parts of the brain to compensate for it now. So I might be using parts of my prefrontal cortex and sort of being a bit more conscious about it. I actually wrote an iPhone app, which people can download, called Chatternome, which speaks the beats out loud. So it goes 1 and 2 and 3. You can make it count in different patterns and things like that. And that helped me also to internalize my rhythm.
We're speaking with Gary Marcus, and on February 12th, he will be at the Cornelia Street Cafe with Gary Lucas, ace guitar player. Gary Marcus talking, Gary Lucas playing, but this Gary will play a little bit too. And we heard that early practice tape. Here's Gary Marcus and a more recent recording called Minor Jazz. That's not bad. Gary Marcus coming a long way, and author of the book Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. He mentioned this app called Chatternome. You'll find a link to it on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. In a moment, we take your calls, and there's a full call slate of them. People willing and waiting to talk about picking up an instrument late in life. Gary Marcus is with us, and a little bit later on in the show, from Guitar Zero, we go to Guitar Hero. Vernon Reed, founding guitarist of the band Living Color, talks about updating his multimedia work called Artificial Africa later on Soundcheck.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song, and I'll try not to sing out of key.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now with cognitive psychologist Gary Marcus, whose new book is called Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. In the background is Gary's cover of Lennon and McCartney's With a Little Help from My Friends. It's Gary singing and playing what? Is this ukulele?
Guitar very low in the
guitar.
Mix. I wish I could say I was playing the ukulele.
And some help from your friends. You've also picked up the bass guitar as well.
So I went to a summer camp of 11-year-olds. And the camp director, Tobias Hurwitz, who wrote The Total Rock Guitarist, calls me up after I've been begging him for months to see if I can come to the camp. And he says, you can come to the camp and you can watch. But if you really want to get a feeling for the camp, you really ought to play in a band. And then he adds, of course, if you want to be in a band, you're going to have to play bass because there's never enough bass players. And at that point, I had only touched a bass once before in my life. I tried to play the opening lick to Psycho Killer in a college student's dorm room. And I didn't understand duration. So I had the notes in the right order, but it didn't sound like anything. But this time I was more dedicated and I started learning the intro riff to Another One Bites the Dust and stuff like that. Not quite sure how the auditions were going to go, how they were going to think about this old guy. And the deal at this summer camp is on Monday you meet your band, and I had to get into a band first.
And they were all 11 years old.
And they were all 11 and 12. So they were older bands with kids that I couldn't have possibly played with. But they hooked me up with a younger band, and the kids were nice enough to have me along. And then the deal is on Monday you meet the band and you start writing a song. And by Friday, they play, their parents come, right? You play on stage in front of the parents. And my parents came too.
I was just going to say, did your parents come?
My parents came. My wife came down from New York. It was anxiolytic is the technical term for something that makes you very anxious.
We're speaking with Gary Marcus. You can speak with him too. We've got lots of calls on the line. We're talking about, you know, picking up an instrument late in life. Is there really something within us that sort of gets stunted as we grow older? Gary doesn't think so and plays the guitar to prove it. Ken is on the line with us from Brooklyn. Hey, Ken.
Hi, John. How are you?
All right. Welcome to Soundcheck. So what's your would-be instrument?
So I actually, this is a great show because this past November I picked up a guitar for the first time, 42 years old, and I'm terrible at it, and I want to know if I missed my window of opportunity when I was 12.
I'm 42 next week, as it turns out. I would ask you how you're going about it. What kind of lessons are you taking? Do you have a coach? I think sometimes people pick a teacher as the guy who played with Hendrix once or something like that, someone who's famous. And what you really want, especially when you're a beginner, is someone who's more like a good car mechanic that can look at you and say, I see what your problem is. This is what we're going to do about it. So I'd say if you're struggling, the first thing to do is to find a teacher who's willing to work with adult beginners and who's not just there to teach you the notes in a song, but there to try to figure out where you're getting stuck and what you can do about it.
What about, like, internet? You know, people are doing these online guitar courses.
We live
stuff.
In the golden era of home self-study. There's tons of free lessons. There's all kind of lessons online that you can pay for. And those things are great, but I mean, I've used them, and I think they're really terrific. But I think there's no substitute for having a teacher who can say, you know, is your posture right? Is your fingering right? And try to get you to fix those habits.
All right. Tina, also on the line with us. Tina, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi. Thank you. I'm 53, and I started taking fiddle lessons about 11 months ago.
Wow.
I found a guy in town, Paul Woodiel, who is a great teacher, and I have to say I agree with the comment. I think being in the presence of a really great musician who can model what you're trying to learn is really helpful. The hardest thing for me is I did have piano background, and like your guest said earlier, every note on the piano has a spot. The fiddle is this huge mystery to me because there are four strings and infinite possibilities.
And you've got the bow.
And you don't have frets.
No frets
and
the bow.
Though he did, I think it's a thing they do with new people, that he did put little pieces of tape on it, which is very helpful.
And so how's it going?
It's actually going surprisingly well. I went in my two statements to him where I said, I'm an adult, so I'm going to tell you what I don't want to do. I don't want to play in front of people. I don't want to do a recital. And I am incapable of memorizing anything. And I truly believed the second statement. I have found that I'm actually able to memorize songs. I had never, in all the years I played piano, I was never able to memorize a piece. And I actually thought I had some sort of weird learning issue. But I have been able to memorize. So that's actually been kind of nice. It's actually been both frustrating, but a really enjoyable part of my life this last year.
The first part of what you said goes back to something that John asked me, which is about what my goals were. So did I want to play like Jimi Hendrix? Did I want to play on stage? And I didn't. And I mean, if I had set those as my goals, that would have been unrealistic.
Right.
I just wanted to deepen my appreciation for music, and I think that's a much more reasonable goal.
I have to say it's actually really nice as an adult to be able to say what you don't want to do. I do think about kids who are told you will do a recital, and I think if that's something that you're afraid of, I think that could really turn you off.
And what about the memorization thing? You talk a lot in the book about language and music and how similar and how different they are, you know, in our brains. And, you know, memorizing to be or not to be, or maybe something in a bit more modern English, is one thing, but memorizing an abstract set of notes on page or fingerings on a fretboard.
That's a real challenge. Music makes really heavy demands on the memory of the brain, and there are different pieces of that. So one is just learning the fretboard, which is probably even harder on on a cello or a violin than it is on a guitar, because you don't have those frets marked out for you. But it's plenty hard enough for guitar. And in fact, if I started over again, I would probably do it with a ukulele, which is a little bit more logical, a little bit simpler. So there's that kind of memory. And then there's the memory for particular songs. There's the memory for particular scales. I've mostly focused on improvisations. I haven't memorized a lot of songs. I'm sort of off the hook on that kind of memory, but I have to learn all the scales and how they work together. So there's another kind of memory I have to develop.
Steve's with us from Reading, Connecticut. Hi, Steve. Welcome to Soundcheck.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I picked up ukulele about a year and a half ago, and I've been listening to your last caller talking about her memory, and it's really a challenge at this point. And the other thing that I'm having a problem with is fingering. My fingers are not as nimble as they used to be. Mm-hmm. But you know what? I'm having a great time. It's a lot of fun, and I'm actually playing some songs and stuff. I just wanted to keep it simple, mm-hmm. and get into something that I could actually get a grip on.
How do you study? Do you study with a teacher, or is it on the internet?
You know, I started out with a teacher, but in my area, at least, most of the teachers are focused on guitar, and it's somewhat similar. But I went to the internet and got a ton of stuff, and not really being aware of, you know, the recent upswing in ukulele enthusiasm. I wasn't prepared for the quantity of information, mm-hmm. but there's a lot there, and it's really been helpful.
If you want to learn uke and you don't have a good uke teacher nearby, there's two things. One is a guitar teacher can probably also teach you a lot about ukulele, especially about the basics, about rhythm and stuff like that. The strumming is a little different, but probably a lot of good guitar teachers could teach you that. And the other is, nowadays there are people who will teach on Skype. I've got some links to some guitar teachers on Skype. At least some of those folks probably could either themselves teach you uke or hook you up with somebody who could. So Skype is another reason we're in the golden era. You can't do everything in a Skype lesson that you can do in a live lesson, but you can still do some.
Now, we're talking about, you know, people who are coming as adults. You know, they've maybe had careers, raised families, and now they're coming to these instruments. None of them, apparently, with the idea of making a second career as a professional touring superstar musician, but just for kind of personal enjoyment, fulfillment. What have you, Gary, gotten out of picking up the guitar and becoming proficient at it?
I've gotten a whole new life, I mean, to be honest. I have a whole new set of friends that are musicians that have welcomed me into their world. Scientists don't always welcome you into their world. You learn a new piece of science, and they're like, hey, that's my territory. What are you doing here? But musicians have been incredibly friendly and incredibly welcoming. And then the other thing is that I got a kind of balance in my life. So my day job is like, you know, about data and numbers and reading the latest studies. And it's often a long delay of gratification. You work on something, it's 3 years before it's published. In music, I just sit there and I start noodling and I practice something new, a new scale or something like that. Like, I just learned a bit of the Eastern Pentatonic scale, which is basically George Harrison's scale. And like that next day, I was playing it with Terry Roach in my lesson with her. From the Roaches. Mm-hmm. And then on my opening night for the book on January 19th, she came out and we did that on stage. It was a little bit better when it wasn't on stage because I was a little bit nervous. But, you know, 2 days later, I was like exploring what was for me anyway, a new piece of musical space. And that was mm-hmm. just wonderful.
All right. There's still calls and comments. Why don't we take another hike into the control room and Joel Meyer with some of the comments.
John, our listener Casey from Maryland heard our clip of Gary playing earlier, and here's Casey's reaction. Again, I just read these comments, John. Ha ha, not bad, Gary. You prove the point, where there's a will, there's a way. Ragnar from Bedminster, New Jersey writes, at the ripe age of 65, I finally started taking drum lessons, and I love it. This is something I've always wanted to do, and so it's never too late. And Jim has a question. Is the professor similarly optimistic about late starters composing music as well as playing it?
I think it can be done. Let me go back just 1 second. On my website, GaryMarcus.com, I have something called Stories. And your readers are welcome to submit stories. And one of my
favorite
listeners, oh dear. your listeners and my readers are welcome to submit stories. And one of the best ones is a woman who's 76 years old, and she says she's been drumming for 2 years, and she doesn't know if she's going to get to 10,000 hours of practice because her husband will only allow her to make her noise an hour a day. and then she follows that up by saying, then again, my dad made it to 103. Her mom made it to 93.
Now, there's a couple of things there. One is you need the time. There's also the 10,000-hour thing. Does that apply to adults who have adult lives and jobs and families, et cetera.
So 10,000 hours is an oversimplification, first of all, for anybody. So there's this idea, if you practice for 10,000 hours, you'll be an expert at anything. And there are a couple of problems. The first is it depends what you're practicing. Tic-tac-toe, if you can't get it in a month, you've got a problem. And guitar is a lot harder. I was talking to Vernon Reed in the reception room, and he said he's still working on it. And Pat Metheny told me the same thing. So the best guitar players are always working on it. And they're not finished after the 10,000 hours.
Right.
And then another thing is that it depends how you practice. So Anders Ericsson talks about what he calls deliberate practice and what I would call targeting your weaknesses. So if you sit there, play the same riff and over for 10,000 hours, you're going to be really good at that riff, but you're not going to know anything else about music. So that's part of why teachers are so important, is they can say, this is what you're strong at and this is what you're weak at, and you can balance it out. And the last thing is talent really does matter. So even if there's no gene for music, there are genes that affect it. The Beatles were, you know, great after 2,000 hours, and I'm at, you know, 1,500 hours, and I'm not approximating the Beatles.
So there is some genetics involved here. You can, I mean, the genetics that allow your fingers to be thin and nimble, for example, is a very useful thing if you're going to pick up the guitar.
Yeah, a funny thing actually is when I started playing guitar before I started writing the book, I was working with a friend on an essay that was going to be called Swim Like Michael Phelps. It was going to be for the Scientific American. And then Michael Phelps got himself in some trouble, and we didn't run the essay. But we were cataloging all the things that made Phelps so suited to swimming, this pear-shaped body and the kind of chemistry that metabolizes food for him and stuff like that. And then I was sitting there playing guitar thinking, my fingers are stubby, and you know, the catalog was in the opposite direction.
Gary Marcus's tale of learning to play the guitar as he approached age 40 is in the book Guitar Zero, The New Musician and the Science of Learning. And Gary, it's been a real pleasure having you with us on Soundcheck.
Thanks so much, John.
Have fun at the Cornelia Street Cafe with Gary Lucas, the guitarist. That'll be on February 12th. Guitar Zero, Gary Marcus on Soundcheck. Coming up next, guitarist Vernon Reed gives us a sneak preview of his newly updated multimedia work, Artificial Africa. That's next. I'm the cult of personality, the cult of personality, the cult of personality. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today is one of those shows where all the real action was happening in the green room. That's where Gary Marcus was really thrilled to have a chance to meet one of Rolling Stone's 100 greatest guitarists of all time. And that guitarist, Vernon Reed, came in a little early to hang out with the cognitive psychologist because, well, that's just the kind of guy he is. Since leading this band, Living Color, to two chart-topping albums, two Grammys, and a tour with the Rolling Stones, Vernon Reed has gone on to projects that involve dancers, kids, video, and a bit of cultural anthropology. The latter comes into play in his ambitious multimedia work, Artificial Africa, which was premiered a couple of years back here in New York, a piece that we commissioned and has been updated now. Vernon, welcome back.
Hey, John, how are you?
I am well. And before we get too far from Gary Marcus and his tale of picking up the guitar, he said that you picked up the guitar first when you were 16.
16 years old, yeah. I started when I was 15 and I couldn't hack it, and then I got back into it when I was 16 and stayed in there.
So what was the difference between you at 15 and you at 16?
Hormonally, probably a lot. I just was like, I was just a little that much more determined to do it.
So it wasn't that you suddenly got some kind of gene
or
something.
The guitar was. I mean, I started the guitar. It was a Dixie. It was a Dixie Hummingbird. It was my cousin's old guitar. He gifted it to me. He was no longer playing. It had a very high action and heavy strings, and my little chicken wrists couldn't handle it, and the guitar was just sitting in my room, and it was just sitting in a corner of the bed, and eventually it was sort of like talking to me,
not literally,
mocking me. And then one day I just picked it up again, and my hands were just that much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't as bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, one day, you know, one fret led to the next, and one day led to the next, and I stayed with it.
So did you put in your 10,000 hours at this point?
Broken up. I'm at my ninth. I'm getting there. My 10,000th hour is approaching.
Yeah. Vernon Reed's with us. Also, Akeem Funk Buddha, who works with you on Artificial Africa. Now, tell us what the big idea behind the original Artificial Africa is.
Okay, so the idea of Artificial Africa is centered around the thought that Africa is, as we know, is a continent, which is a compendium of cultures, and a complex compendium of cultures. But Africa is also a country of the mind, in that there's an undifferentiated idea that exists about the continent Africa.
The dark continent.
The dark continent, or Mother Africa, or a lot of other things that have been projected onto it. And that area, what has happened through the collisions of different cultures forced to mix, what happened with colonialism, what's happened with post-colonialism, what happened in the diaspora taken out of Africa, and the oscillations between the diaspora and Africa, that's really where Artificial Africa actually is. Artificial is a word that's very pejorative,
mm-hmm.
because artificial for many people means fake. And there is a part of that, but artificial is also, think of it as artificial intelligence, that many cultural memes and ideas have been morphed and changed and mutated into other forms.
So Artificial Africa is not just you shredding on the guitar. It's a multimedia work, because
yeah.
a lot of this plays out in visual imagery.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like I was influenced by My Life in the Bush of Ghosts.
The Brian Eno, David Byrne record.
Right.
Where they appropriated sounds from other parts of the world.
Absolutely. That was. And then I went and read the Amos Tachiola book,
mm-hmm.
which is
West African novelist.
Which is an incredible, I mean, it's as mind altering as Lewis Carroll. I mean, seriously. And it's what's shocking to me is I recently went to try to find an electronic version of My Life in the Bush, My Life in the Bush of Ghosts, like
the book, you mean?
Yeah, either an audio book, mm-hmm. or an electronic. And there is no version of it, which is kind of shocking to me, because it's one of the preeminent fantasy alternate reality books, and it's also reading William Gibson, like the Sprawl trilogy, Neuromancer.
Mm-hmm.
So the
mm-hmm.
the opening line of Neuromancer is, "The sky above the port was the color of a TV tuned to a dead channel." And one of the characters in My Life in the Bush of Ghosts is the television-handed ghostess. And so there, in my kind of mixed master of a mind, those things are connected,
mm-hmm.
in a way. And then when I got my first computer, my first Mac, I started out, before I got music programs, I got Photoshop. And I went and saw this film by Richard Linklater called Waking Life, where it was actual DV footage that was turned into animation. It wasn't drawn. It was actual footage that was turned into animation. And then I stumbled into some off-the-shelf programs that allowed me to do it, and one thing led to another thing, and that's how it started.
It started, and it took you years, and finally we commissioned you to finish the damn thing, which you did, and we premiered it in 2009 at the World Financial Center, and this is a little bit of just the musical portion. There's a whole video stream that's going on at the same time. Vernon Reed's Artificial Africa. Vernon Reed, the guitarist and composer, and a little bit of his multimedia work, Artificial Africa. That's the debut, the premiere of what was then the final version. There is now an updated version of Artificial Africa that we're talking to Vernon about. Akeem Funk-Buda is part of the ensemble that was with you that night at the World Financial Center and is with us here today. And Akeem, what's your role in Artificial Africa?
That's a very good question. I would say I have many roles, and I'm letting the roles reveal themselves to me. I am participating as a sonic artist, sonic meaning sound. I'm a MC. I do overtone throat singing. I beatbox. I do sound effects.
Now, how many MCs do Asian-style overtone throat singing? That's a rare skill set.
Well, let me say this. Not many, but I've met a few who are doing the low end, but they don't know that they're doing the low end. They don't necessarily have the overtones happening, but they are in a certain vicinity of the throat that is almost equivalent to the throat singing. So I've had a few interesting discussions because I'm into it as an urban chant as well.
Now, are you do you come to a performance of Vernon's piece with prepared texts, a kind of a narrative, or just kind of abstract images that you want to make sure get into into the mix?
Yeah, at this point, a bit of both, because it's a piece of work that is growing. I have usually a set of ideas that I would like to be included, and I, you know, either speak to Vernon about it or I draw them out because I like to draw more so than write. But sometimes when the session starts, the ideas I have written down might get thrown out of the window because I might feel something else. So I do participate as well as a performance artist / dancer choreographer within the piece.
And Vernon, do you see, you're doing this this whole month at Dixon Place on the Lower East Side, this new version of Artificial Africa, A Tale of Lost Cities, with Akeem and with DJ Leon Lamont. Do you see this as kind of an extension maybe of the African storytelling, the griot or the jolly, as it's known, the griot tradition of West Africa?
I definitely see it that way. And it's extended. The thing about it is that it's also using the medium of electronics, live music, electronics, video art, animation, stop motion animation, which is a nightmare. Nightmare. And also DJ Leon Lamont also helped a great deal with editing some of the latter pieces. One of the idea of the tale of lost cities.
All right, you know, let me stop you there, because before we get too much into the new thing, I want to give people a chance to hear Akeem in action from our 2009 performance of Artificial Africa. This is, again, from the world premiere of the piece by Vernon Reed.
You can feel the flow because it is lethal. We've all been stung by the venom. 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 But it's time to heal. It's the venom, but now it's time to heal. Venom, but it's time to heal. It's the venom. It's time to heal. It's the venom.
A little bit of Vernon Reed's Artificial Africa featuring Akeem Funk-Buda. So, Akeem, there was some of that overtone singing that you were talking about at the end there, as well as some more conventional
spoken word. Rhyme.
And you do some beatboxing and some dancing. And what are you doing, Vernon?
Pushing buttons. Playing frets, you know.
So now it's Artificial Africa, A Tale of Lost Cities. Go.
All right, so A Tale of Lost Cities, one of the later pieces, is actually from slavery. An old, a lot of the footage is public domain footage that I've transformed into video art and animation. And there's an old British film called Slavery in the World Today. And there's a section of that piece which is centered around essentially a slave city, a town.
Where?
Oh, my goodness.
This country or?
No, in Africa.
In Africa, okay.
And it's it starts, and once I started working on that piece, I started thinking about how urbanism has changed landscape. And the idea that if there's, like, in the Heart of Darkness, the Heart of Darkness actually lives in the cities. And I started looking into that, and I found some very interesting pieces that I started working in.
And is that why Artificial Africa has largely a very urban sound?
Yeah, I would say so.
This is a little bit of the new version of Artificial Africa, a tale of lost cities, incorporating some actual footage recorded
outside in Lagos, Nigeria.
Artificial Africa, a tale of lost cities. That is a new updated version of the big multimedia piece by Vernon Reed, who plays guitar. You heard a little, just a little bit of these voices in Lagos, Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
And the balafone, the marimba-like thing, is that also from a found recording?
Yes. Or,
okay, so that provides sort of the rhythm track for this excerpt from a tale of lost cities. Being performed here in New York at Dixon Place, February 10th through 25th with Akeem Funk Buddha and DJ Leon Lamont, 7:30. It's like a Friday-Saturday series.
Friday-Saturday. It's every Friday-Saturday from next weekend on.
And it is, as you said, kind of carrying on this idea of our sort of distant and artificial view of Africa. There are lots of manifestations of artificial Africa in the United States.
In the United States and in Africa, too.
But one of them here just passed away,
and that is
Don Cornelius, the founder of Soul Train.
I mean, one could say if artificial Africa is a country, there's certain potentates or kings. I would say Sun Ra is one. George Clinton is another. And without doubt, Don Cornelius, the host of Soul Train, would be yet another one, and his loss is really kind of seismic, because what he did with Soul Train, I mean, it changed the culture of the nation. It changed world culture. You know, Soul Train wasn't just something that was massive for black people. It was massive for everybody in America, and it had a massive effect in countries like South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It had a massive effect. You know, people in Brazil, where people were mad for it, and there's some incredible performances. You know, Al Green live, David Bowie live, with Luther Vandross singing background.
Right.
I mean, so many James Brown performances. Herbie Hancock and Headhunters, which is yet again another artificial African manifestation.
Mm-hmm. So the loss of Don Cornelius.
It's massive. It's very, very, very sad, and he will be very much missed. But he did something tremendous for world culture.
Well, on Monday's program, in the wake of Don Cornelius' death, we are going to look back at the importance of Soul Train in television history and in American race relations. And, of course, there's the whole musical aspect. So that's coming up on Monday. Let me thank both of you, Vernon Reed, Akeem Funk Buddha,
yeah,
along with DJ Leon Lamont. They're doing Vernon's piece, Artificial Africa, A Tale of Lost Cities, at Dixon Place, Fridays and Saturdays in February. Guys, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much,
John. Thank you.
Well, Soul Train actually had a bunch of theme songs over the years, but to many of us, this is the one. And again, we'll get the history of Soul Train on Monday's program. Also Monday, on the eve of his first orchestral release, the violinist Ray Chen stops by to perform some of his favorite solo violin works and to talk fashion, apparently. And don't forget, we want to hear from people with incredible collections of music-related stuff. Concert t-shirts, memorabilia, magazines, rare instruments, whatever you got. Check out the amazing super collections that have already been nominated and nominate yourself or another super collector that you know on our webpage, wnyc.org/soundcheck. Our technical director is Irene Trudell, the program produced by Katie Bishop and Greta Cohn. Our senior producer is Joel Meyer. We had help today from Gina Joldasis. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.